Everyone has a story. I get them to tell it. Welcome to the Aaron Bender Podcast, conversations with media personalities about their personal and professional lives and journeys. Thank you so much for all your support, all the views, all the downloads on your favorite platforms and watching on YouTube or IGTV or on DBNA TV, streaming with the DBNA TV app on Amazon Fire, Roku, and Apple TV, or nightly 11 p.m. Pacific or 2 a.m. Eastern on DBNA TV, a streaming at dbnatelevision.tv. Before we get to my conversation with Kristen Aguirre, a little about my story. I'm a widowed dad of two girls who just lost their mom, a grieving husband, a man in recovery trying to reconnect with the world with fresh eyes, faith, and perspective, a college journalism professor, a white guy in a world of injustice, a 20-year broadcast media veteran who had his dream job and then lost it. A year and a half ago, God gave me a gift, an opportunity to stop, step back, and breathe so I can learn about love, vulnerability, forgiveness, grace, self-care, patience, and understanding. Kristen Aguirre is a reporter and anchor in Asheville, North Carolina. She's only in her 30s, but she is a stroke survivor. And if you remember my podcast guest from a couple of months ago, Lori Lizarraga, Kristen is one of the Latinas let go by Nine News in Denver.
I'm one of those dog moms that buys their dog like therapy meds and whatever.
Hey.
Because I feel so bad when I'm at work. She's my baby, so it's like she gets the best of everything.
Nice. Very cool.
I'd rather go without groceries for a week if she can get a freaking therapy med.
Nice. Well, we'll talk about the pups.
She's actually my second one. My first friend, she died last year. So it's, I had this stroke, got fired, got this dog that was amazing, and then she died. It was like one right after another.
Wow,
yeah.
Kristen.
When she died, that like really broke me. I was a disaster.
You're like,
that.
Give me the stroke. Give me determination.
Yeah.
Give me the hellish job search during a pandemic.
Sure.
Do not take my dog.
I was like hysterically crying on the phone with my boyfriend at the time. I was like, this is the worst day of my life. He's like, Kristen, this is not the worst day of your life. I was like, it is though.
You don't understand.
Yeah, I'm like, the stroke was whatever, but my dog, oh my God, it was really bad after that.
I'm leaving all this in, by the way, because I think it's a great start to things, a great intro, but take me to April 13th, 2019, morning of, all good. Afternoon
sure, yeah,
nap,
morning of,
all good
completely,
also.
Everything normal, like totally normal. I went to it, like I was healthy. I mean, I went to a spin class in the morning, and then after that, I went to a fundraiser for Latinas. I was really involved with the Latino community in Denver. So I went to a fundraiser. Everything was fine. They were serving alcohol, but I had to go to work. So I was like, no, I can't. I mean, I was tempted, but it's like, I got to go to work. Can't do it. And so I came home and I run late everywhere. I mean, I was late for this podcast. Like, so
we don't need to tell anybody that. That's fine.
I mean, everyone who knows me, I want to be on time and I try really hard, but I just end up late. So I get home and I've had a migraine here, and they kind of run in my family a little bit. Like my mom used to get them when she was like in her late 20s, early 30s. So occasionally I had my first one in Flint and I really didn't think anything of it. You know, even in Flint, it was like, it's a migraine. My mom told me to shut the blinds, take a nap, and then that got rid of it. So that was kind of what I did. I got them seriously like once or twice a year, like never like even like one, twice in a week, nothing like that. So I could feel a migraine coming on. And I thought, oh my God, I'm going to have to call into work because you can barely open your eyes. People who suffer from migraines know it's like, you can't even like open your eyes sometimes because you're so sensitive to light. And I thought, you know what, let me take a quick 20-minute nap. I thought it was like 1 o'clock. And so, I mean, I was supposed to get into work at 2:33, but I mean, if that was a little late, I was like, whatever. So I'll just close my eyes for 20 minutes and then I'll be ready to go. And I fell asleep. And then the next thing I knew, I was waking up to my boyfriend banging on the door, telling me to let him in, that I had missed my show and everyone was worried about me. And that was really a moment. Like, I just remember being like, so like mind boggled, like, what do you mean I missed my show? Like I fell asleep for 20 minutes. And I mean, dating me has got to be, you know, God bless the man I've dated, honestly. So he's banging on the door, which would never fly with me. So naturally, I was screaming at him through the door to shut up because he was embarrassing me in front of my neighbors. And he kept telling me to open the door. And so finally, I was so mad. I just went to sit up and I went to open the door like, oh, I'm going to beat his ass. And as soon as I got up, we think that stroke must have happened already because I was completely paralyzed on my left side, but I didn't know that yet.
Yeah.
So I went to stand up and I fell immediately and hit my head off my dresser. And I must have passed out after that because I woke up again and Darren was still banging on the door and I was still yelling at him. But at this time he was, I could hear it in his voice. He was like very concerned. And so he called my sister and I are very, very close. And he was on the phone. I could hear him outside. He's like, Christy won't answer the door. And my sister was like, okay. And so he was like, I'm going to have Kristen call you right now. I'm going to have Caitlin call you. And she was like, okay. And then my phone was right above kind of where I had fell.
Yeah.
So I was able to reach it. And I answered it and she was like, what's happening? I was like, nothing, I'm fine. Like, even in that moment, like I'm laying on the ground, don't really remember what's been happening. I was like, it's fine. Like, I don't, the last thing I want to do is like worry my family.
Right.
Like, I'm fine. Nothing's wrong. It's going to be fine. And she's like, well, Darren's upset and he wants to know, like, is this something that you usually do? And I told her, well, yeah, like if she didn't want to talk to you, she would not answer the door. And so by this time I was like, it's totally fine. But they were like, no, this is, something is not right. So by that time, Darren had called the ambulance and.
Oh, really?
He was just like, enough's enough. I mean, like I said, it's like dating me. You have to like read through the lines. He was like, something is not right. So he called the ambulance and then the first responders came in. And truthfully, I had just cleaned my floors. I was so mad. Like, cause all I could see was laying on the floors, like their boots coming in. I was like, oh my God. Like even in these moments, still like the thought of like having a stroke or being something more than whatever. I don't know. I just thought maybe I overslept or I didn't know what was going on. So the first responders came in. And I think what's really, really special about my story is that throughout the whole thing, I'm very close with my faith. And I had like these little God moments that I felt like he was telling me like, listen, this is going to be hard. Yes, but you're going to be fine. So the first responders come in, they were younger, very sweet. And one was a woman and, you know, they're doing the whole like, okay, squeeze my hand. And I could do it on my right side. And this is when I was like, what is happening? So they had me squeeze on my left, but I couldn't move it. I was like, I'm trying. And they're like, come on, Kristen, like you can do it. And I was like, I can't. And then I could see them like looking at each other, like what is happening with this girl? So the first responder, her name was Caitlin, which is the same as my sister's. And it was just like, I don't know why. It was just like calming. Like I just felt like, okay, it's going to be, there's a little reminder from God. Like, here's a comforting name in this minute of chaos. It's going to be okay. So she was very sweet and like was holding my hand really all the way until the ambulance. And then we get into the ambulance and this is truthfully my favorite story of my entire journey. So Darren and I had been dating like casually, like a couple months. We worked together. He's a photographer at the station, but we were friends and we were just like casually dating. So he jumps in the ambulance with me and the first responder is like, you know, trying to talk to me, like it's going to be okay. And at this point they thought I had a complex migraine, which apparently like shows the same symptoms as
stroke.
Oh, interesting.
Okay.
Yeah. I was like, okay. You know, so I'm like, okay, fine. Cause they like could not, there was no way I could have a stroke. Right. I'm so young. So we hop in the car or the back of the ambulance and I'm on the stretcher and the first responder is like, who's this guy? And I was like, I think he's my boyfriend. And then we just start laughing. And I was like, ladies, this is dating in your 30s. Like I'm quite literally on my deathbed, still worried that I'm putting too much pressure on the man I'm dating. Like it was, but we were just laughing so hard. And so that's how Darren became my boyfriend.
You should have said fiance or something like that. Just really put the pressure. Yeah.
I know. Oh God. I know. I should have done that. Really missed that. So then we get to the hospital and a bunch of my coworkers are there already, like worried about me. And it was, which was really nice. Like a lot of my bosses and managers were at my apartment already. Like kind of, I was yelling and it's so weird. Like the medical situation in America, like as I'm getting the ambulance, I'm like, pack my card, like my insurance card, because I knew like they wouldn't take me if I didn't have insurance.
Right.
And so we get to the hospital and we get to the back and all the doctors are talking. And by this time my facial droop was starting to show, which I didn't really know or notice. And they kept saying, like, oh no, she's fine. Like there's no way she had a stroke. She's too young. Like this is like a stigma even doctors have to overcome. Like stroke can happen at any age. And so one of my managers actually was like, look at her face. Like she's a beautiful woman and look at her face. Like this is, something is not right. Like they were just like, oh, it's a complex migraine. And they actually didn't give me a CAT scan for 8 hours because my parents didn't get the call till like 1 a.m. after they ran the CAT scan finally to show that I had a stroke.
Right.
So it took them forever to kind of run those tests. But yeah. So then after that, it's so funny every time I tell this story, like it never gets easier. Cause I'm always like, oh, like here's 5 minutes of a story that really altered my entire life. So then I was in the hospital for 3 months recovering. And then I got out and did outpatient therapy and got fired and got a new job. And here I am.
Yeah.
And that's it.
And enjoy. Kristen, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. That's all the time we have. No, I wanted to lead with this because this is not like, oh, I got married and let's talk about, you know, my life before and life after. Oh, sure. I graduated from college. No, this is life and death. This is prior to this. Sure. This was my life prior. And I came out the other side of this. There is no, well, let's lead up to it and maybe we'll talk a little bit about it. No, this is the only reason you are here is because you survived what happened April 13th, 2019.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really weird. Like when I tell people stories for a living and, you know, it's easy to like craft like, oh my God, this person's a great character. I can't wait to tell their story. When I think about my story, like I don't really think about it like that. Like I look at it like that was the only path that was really an option for me because that's just like who I am. And there were certain moments in the hospital that really fueled me. And one of them is I'm very, very close to my family. There's four of us. It's my parents and my sister, and we are creepily close. My sister and I sometimes have to like really put some boundaries with our parents. We're like, okay, there are certain things we shouldn't talk about. But my parents are really young. They're in their 50s. So I would say like we grew up together. They were in their early 20s when they, especially with me, when they had, like they're more like traditional parents with Caitlin, but with me, like they had no idea what they're doing. Like I still don't think they know what they're doing, but they're the best. So we're very, very close. And there was a point in the hospital, my doctor, and I was really close with my team. They were like, listen, you know, typically young female adults who have a stroke recover quicker than anyone else. And I just felt so thankful in that moment because I thought, I'm very much a woman, like put me in the game, give me the ball, 5 seconds left on the clock. Like I'm that kind of chick. So for them to say like, hey, you know, if God was going to make this happen to somebody in my family, wouldn't I want it to be me? Because like the idea of sitting next to my dad, watching him learn to walk again, or my mom, who, I mean, they're truly the best, most supportive parents. Like, I don't know if I could have had that much strength that they showed me like every day. Like every day wasn't like, okay, you know, we're going to walk today. It's going to be great. You know, there were some days where I was like, why the fuck did this happen to me? I hate today. I hate my life. Like I just, mental health is like a whole nother thing. Like, you know, there were some days where I just really just wanted to kill myself because I just didn't know if I would make it to this moment that I'm in right now. And like, I just don't know if I would have had that strength that they did. So if this was going to happen to me, like, I'm glad it was me, not my little sister, not my mom, not my dad. And so, I mean, it is what it is, especially now, like looking at all of that on the other side, it's just crazy.
Without them by your side, because rehab and therapy, while I've not gone through it physically, it's mm-hmm. something you need to do yourself.
To you know, heal, 100%.
Nobody can walk for you. Nobody can right. heal your childhood trauma other than you. You know, name the thing you need therapy for, and it can mm-hmm. only be done with you. How did you, talk about mental health, how did you summon that strength?
Really, for me, it was like my faith. And the best thing about being at Craig is that they really encourage like family support. So my dad was actually able to work remotely and my mom's was a stay-at-home mom. So they were able to stay there with me every single day at therapy. So, you know, every day we'd really look for like the small victories. And so every day, if my toe wiggled when I was completely paralyzed, we were like so excited. And it's like, look up and to see my parents there, like embracing those moments, like that really pushed me because I thought I want to get back to those moments. But even if it was going to be in a wheelchair, like I want to feel good about who I am, and embracing those small victories really helped me get there. And then really having like the best medical team I could have, like, they were really, really behind like getting Christy to feel how she used to feel. Yeah. My family calls me Christy, so that's just kind of what comes out. But yeah, they were really like, okay, what did you like to do before you came in here? Like, oh, I used to always get my nails done like a couple, you know, once or twice a month. That's just like something that makes me feel good. And so, you know, they were getting really ratchet in there. And so they set up a time to go out to a nail salon. And those moments were really scary because I thought, because my hand was so weak. And there's this thing called tone that you can get after a stroke where it kind of, your muscles kind of tense up a little bit and they can fist. And so mine wasn't completely in a fist, but they would be rough some days. So like the first couple of times I got my nails done, I'd have my therapist and my mom there, and they would be there helping me hold my hand. And I just kept thinking, like, I don't want to get my nails done like this forever. And those were the moments I was like, okay, so what do we have to do to make sure that I can live on my own and get my own nails done by myself? And those are the moments that really fueled me. But to have a team that was like, okay, well, let's figure out how Kristen can get her nails done, or she, you know, does facials, or used to love to run. So what are we going to do every single day a little bit to get you back to the things that you love? And that's kind of what really fueled me.
And also looking at God's timing in all this, if this had happened after you were fired, imagine, you know, the insurance, the bills, things like that. If this had happened on your weekend and you had no plans that weekend, there's nobody knocking on your door saying you missed a show. Well, there was no show to miss.
That's, I always think about, what if I had called my boss, was like, listen, I have a migraine, I'm not coming in. Like, nobody would have noticed for days I was not there. I mean, I would 100% be dead. So I was thankful I didn't do, like, so many little things like that. Like, thankfully this didn't happen in Flint, where I was before Denver. You know, it happened in Denver, where I was at a place that had one of the best rehab hospitals for brain injury and spinal cord. Like, what are the odds that that happened, that I was in a city that had those, you know? And even when I was unconscious still at the hospital, my parents were talking to the team about, well, you know what, maybe we'll just take her home to Chicago, which also has a Shirley Ryan Rehabilitation Center, which is one of the best in the nation as well. And I just always thought, how lucky am I that I was able to be treated by the top of the top. And you know what had happened to me, like, I was among the doctors that were making waves, that are making these breakthroughs. And
yeah, I mean,
if that is such a blessing.
If this happened earlier in your career, whether it's Flint or, you know, Great Falls, Montana or something like that,
right?
You know, God bless those doctors and nurses, but they don't have, they don't have the resources. They don't have the technology. They don't have the innovations that the big cities do, like Denver, like Chicago, like LA.
Oh, yeah. I think, yes, timing is everything. Like, it happened. I was sad, of course, at the beginning, because I felt like I was at the peak of my career. But because I was at the peak, I was able to step back into the position that I am now. And I don't think I'm starting from scratch. I'm starting with experience. But because I had all that under my belt, I was still such a marketable candidate, you know?
Yeah. What was go ahead.
There were people that, I mean, I had interviewed with, I won't name where they were, but were so obsessed with my stroke, like, would not. So what happened at 9? Like, is this an interview or are you just trying to be nosy? It was really hard looking for a job. And then I came across this place with this boss, and it was just another God moment where, like, everything just clicked. Like, Brian, who's my boss, his first phone call to me, I was like, oh, hi, we're setting up an interview. He's like, hi, I just want to let you know we're really familiar with brain injury here. And I was like, what? And my predecessor actually had a brain injury.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, it's so crazy. And so he had told me a little bit about, my predecessor had a lot of cognitive issues, which for me was mostly physical and not too many cognitive issues. So they were already, like, well-versed on kind of the fatigue and how things can get a little fuzzy for people. So they were like, oh, we have support here. And they were, it was, you know, you hear people say that, you're like, yeah, okay, whatever.
Right.
I mean, by the time I started, I really didn't need that much support, because, like, my fatigue had really subsided. I mean, I can still get tired here and there, but not how it was in the beginning. But,
and it's interesting the idea that they are not shying away from that, saying, hey, we've already dealt with this. We don't want to have to keep dealing with it with somebody else, somebody new. They're like, oh, no, we know how to deal with this. We welcome that, because we want to support you, because we are a fan of yours as a journalist.
It was really weird. Like, if I felt like tomorrow I had to go into work and I was sick, or I just had a bad brain day, I have no problem feeling I could call Brian. I mean, listen, I'm going to call out. He'd be like, all right, well, take a day and we'll talk tomorrow or whatever. Yeah. Like, the thought of doing that in Denver, like, I would go in like half dead and call out.
Well, and I do want to get into what happened at Denver. I did mention in the intro to the podcast that you are one of the three people that Lori Lizarraga, former podcast guest, wrote about in her article for Westword in Denver. talking about Latinx and Nine News. You know, it's you, it's Sonia, it's Lori. You know, we'll talk about what happened with you three there. Sure. But I do want to just kind of put a bow on the stroke recovery. What was your therapy timeline? You talked about, you know, you were in a rehab center. At what point did you feel like, oh, okay, I can walk again and walk normally? I can do things now that, you know, 2 months ago I couldn't do. You know,
I mean, I don't think I'm ever going to be normal again, whatever the hell that is. But right. I really don't think,
yeah,
like,
let's
I
throw
think
the word normal out
brain
the window,
injury survivors this... know that. I mean, things are rewired up here. And I mean, is my personality back? Is the way I think, the way I write back? Sure. But it's, of course, different. Like, I'm a different journalist now. I've been through things. I look, you know, do it through a different lens now than I did before. And I think that really impacts my storytelling. But yeah, I think it was like 3 months before I could walk again, 2 to 3 months. And my team actually was like, our first meeting was like, they called them conferences. That was really the worst thing ever. They were like, listen, you're probably going to leave here in a wheelchair just because of where the stroke had hit. And I just remember looking at my dad. So I only have sisters. So my entire life, my dad has really raised us to be like, listen, the only man you need in life is your dad. Like, you can do whatever you want. Like, every single day, my parents are like, whatever your dream is, like, we'll support you. So that's just like, that's kind of my mindset, like my whole life. And so after the meeting, my dad was like, okay, like, so how do you feel? I'm like, well, they think I'm never going to walk again. He's like, well, what do you think? And there was just something that, there's nothing wrong with it, right? But there was just something in me that was like, this is not your path. Like, it's just not your path. So I had told him that, and he's like, okay, so what are we going to do every single day to get you to run again and walk? So on the weekends, I mean, I would bust my ass in therapy every day. And I, you know, and all they would, I'd have like, okay, you want to do this exercise or this one? Which one is harder? And I would do that. Like, I would do my best. And then even on the weekends, we would go to the gym. And there was actually an officer that was rehabbing there as well. And he was there every weekend too. And I just kept thinking like, okay, if he can do this, I can do this. Yeah. And it was really looking at like my peers that were recovering, some of them from like things that were worse than me, I thought. And so they kind of really gave me strength. And so then first it started off with like a toe wiggle. And my therapist was like, this is how it starts. And it really was. So it was like a toe wiggle. And then we started trying, then it was like up my calf. And then we were able to do like walking on the bars. And then after the bars, I had like my first cane, or I did a walker first. And then after the walker, you get like a 4-prong cane, and then it's just a 1-prong cane. And then before you knew it, I was walking. I mean, it sounds so quick, but I mean, this was like a week or two. It was really quick, actually. It was like toe wiggle, week later, the bars, a week later, the cane, a week later, nothing. And then it wasn't until outpatient rehab that we really worked on running, where it was like more high functioning things. And then my arm didn't move for almost 6 months. It was crazy. Like, every day I'd come back from therapy just so defeated, because they really worked your ass. So it was like up at 7 a.m. to like 5 in the afternoon, therapy nonstop, like whether it was cognitive for my hand, for my leg, there's always something. So even after I'd come back from therapy, and I would try to do these exercises where I would move a washcloth with my hand, and I couldn't do it forever. And oh my God, it was so frustrating. But that's where having my parents there, they'd be like, okay, well, you know what, why don't we stop right now? Because you're getting really frustrated. And then we can try tomorrow will be better. Yeah. And that was just kind of our mentality. Tomorrow will be better. Even if my arm doesn't move, tomorrow's going to be better. And then it was just one day I just tried moving it. I mean, I was trying to move it constantly, and I was able to move it in bed, and my parents caught it on camera. And it's such a sweet video, because you could hear my mom in the background. She's like a really big crier, and she's crying. She's like, oh my God, she's crying. And I'm like, mom, shut up. It's really funny. And so then we had that movement going, and then slowly but surely my fingers came. I mean, that it took a while. It took a long time. And really it was just every day, like trying to strengthen whatever I could move. And really just kind of thinking, I always think like, okay, so even if this is the only movement I get back, how are we going to make it work everyday life so I can live by myself? And I love my parents, but it's time to like get on my own again. And so I just really kept building off that. And now it's like, I wouldn't say my hand is perfect. It's still like fine motor skills are a little bit tough, but to me, if that's the worst thing I'm living with, like, whatever.
From one napper to another, an expert napper, I feel like, you know, I could do a 3-minute nap and just boom, go to the rest of the day, 5 minutes, 10 minutes. Obviously my ideal one is like 30 to 45. I want to ask if there was any kind of triggering when you would like, okay, I need a nap. Oh, wait a minute. The last time I napped, or that's what happened. Anything like that, that you had to deal with and get over?
Honestly, not until I was more healed. Cause I just desperately needed those naps. Like I didn't even have time to wonder like, oh my God, last time we did this, you almost died.
During recovery.
Like,
yeah.
You're going to nap right here.
Yeah.
Right in this very moment. So no, I never had those. It wasn't until I was living on my own again, that those thoughts really started to seep in. And I went to therapy and really had my therapist help me kind of work through those moments where it was triggering and anxiety would like flood in. And anyway, just kind of, you know, work through things like prayer or meditation. That's really like helped me like calm. And I mean, they're still there. They're going to be there. Like those thoughts are there forever. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same thing as like when I get home late from work and I'm like, oh my God, am I going to get raped and murdered right now? It's like, okay, it's going to be fine. We're just going to make it to the door, get in and shut the door. So, but therapy has helped me so, so much with all of that.
What happened at 9 News? I mean, obviously we're going to link in the show notes the article that Lori wrote and that, you know, we talked about in the podcast a couple of months ago. But from your perspective, and also what went into the decision on your end to co-sign that article?
Okay, so what happened at 9 is I got discharged from the hospital in June. And there was a lot of support, right? But I think what people don't know is, yes, 9 looked like they were really supportive, but that wasn't my managers. Those were like my best friends that were coming to the hospital every day or organizing the stroke walk for me. That wasn't like managers that were like, hey, we have to do this for Christy. That was Danielle planning everything, making t-shirts. That was, you know, the people who loved me that were with me. Those were the people that were doing that. And so I got discharged in June, and right away, Craig was like, okay, here's a therapist that was designed to, I forget what her entire title is called, but it's basically a therapist that works with you to get you back to work. So she came on right away, great, loved her, and was basically the liaison between me and 9. And so initially we went in, she looked at my desk, like luckily I didn't have any like deficits where I needed like special equipment. Mm-hmm. And so that worked. And we started off initially with like run through shows, like practice shows. And yeah, they were bad. And that's because not only did I recover from a stroke, but I hadn't done that. I hadn't anchored a show in almost a year. Like, of course I was going to be rusty. So we did that a couple times. And I remember looking at my boss's face, like the first time I ran through, and I could see her. She was like, I mean, I was good at my job. I'm still good at my job. But yes, I was bad at when I first went back. Like it was rusty.
Yeah, yeah.
They were really so honed in that I didn't sound like myself. My voice was off. I didn't have my anchor voice anymore. And they were just like really obsessed with that. So it was like every day we'd have these meetings. Like I think one of the first meetings I had with Tim Ryan, we went in. He was like, yeah, no, the anchoring is just not for us. So, I mean, I knew after that meeting that I was just like, okay. Like, this is not going to go the way we thought it was going to go. So like, just be prepared.
Yeah.
And then it was like, after that, like, it was just another meeting about how this wasn't good enough. And I was no longer up to 9 standards. And it was just meeting after meeting about how much I sucked. And that was it. It was just constantly, like at the very least once a week.
And Lori talked about going into it, like, okay, do I write this article knowing that I could be, you know, this could be a career death sentence. I might not be able to get another job on the air again because of what I'm calling out 9 News for.
Mm-hmm.
In doing so, you know, she's talking about you. She's talking about Sonia. You were the 3 Latina reporters let go by 9 News over the course of a year. What went into your decision to co-sign that, knowing the risks?
I guess I didn't even really care about the risk because I felt like what happened to me could never happen, shouldn't happen to anybody else. And really, I felt so blessed because I had just the best support system that there's no way everybody who's going to go through some sort of illness like this there is going to have that same support system. Like, okay, great. I got fired and that's horrible, but I mean, I did have savings. I was able to leave Denver and come home and live with my parents, but not everybody has that. And so that for me, I just kept thinking about the person behind me. What would happen if this happened to them? Because stroke hits 1 in 6 people, and everybody gets disabled in their life unless they die young. And so I feel like,
oh, that's interesting.
I really
interesting perspective.
I really had to set a precedent. And that's what they said when they fired me, that, you know, they were like, well, we have to set a precedent. And I remember thinking, like, the precedent is what? You get sick and you come back and you can't come back and you get fired. And I just, and I was just so done with them at that point when they were firing me, that I was like, just get me the hell out of this building. I don't care. Yeah, I will sign whatever. Just get me out of here. And so in that moment, and I just had so much to say, but really didn't have like a platform, and I was scared. I felt very much alone after I had gotten fired, so I didn't really say much. And Westward had actually reached out, was like, let's do an interview. And my couple of people, mentors that I reached out to, my agent was like, let's not do that. And I kind of, for a while, so I just went with their advice because they had never, like,
This is a bridge you've never crossed before.
And so I just said, okay. But it was like months later when I was home that I had kind of gotten angry and was like, oh my God, I should have did that article. And then Lori was like, hey, I'm going to do this article. Do you mind if I talk about you? And I was like, no, like, let's do it. And because I had so much to say about it, and I felt like now was the time, and really prayed on it so long that I really think when it comes to timing, like, God was like, listen, now's not the time. Like, we're going to hold off to tell your story, and it's going to be way more powerful when you come together with two other women. And that's what happened.
Wow.
So yeah, when she was like, can I kind of use your story? It was like, yeah.
Yeah. Goosebumps hearing that, the idea that again, you know, you do not have to go through therapy alone. You've got your support system. You do not have to go through this article alone. You've got this support system, this team of people. It's so much easier to carry a burden
with others. Yes. Like, having like Sonia and Lori and both of them on either side of me has been just such a blessing. Like, the article itself has been very triggering, and just because you don't know how people are going to proceed. We didn't know how it was going to come out. There's no way we thought it was going to have this big of an impact and that there would actually be support or changes being done, you know?
Right.
And so on the days where we are having, there's anxiety between all of us, it's so nice to like lean on them and be like, guys, when is this NPR article coming out? Because I'm going to have an anxiety attack. Like, it's going to be fine. And so it's nice to have them, but I'm so glad I waited and let Lori. The other thing is that I really trust Lori as a friend, as a journalist. So I knew like whatever she was going to write, it was going to be truthful. And I had known what they were doing to her, you know, the entire, cause we were close. So I had known what they were doing to her. And so I knew whatever she was going to write, it was going to be truthful and it was going to be powerful. And that's why I was like, yeah, use me however you want.
Yeah. And the idea that since I've talked with Lori and since you and I talked about doing this podcast, you've been awarded by the National Association of Hispanic Journalists for your efforts. The three of you are recognized for that.
Unbelievable. I mean, when we heard that, so the three of us watched the awards together, like we did it on a FaceTime, and talk about triggering. As soon as we won that, like Sonia and I were like bawling our eyes out, and just the idea that everything we went through, not that, you know, we went through everything to get an award, but that maybe some people saw like the things we went through and how powerful they've really come to terms. We were just crying, and it was just such a special moment. One of us taped it, which is weird because it's just like us crying. Be like, I can't believe we won.
Well, it's like the video of your mom crying in the background when you move your arm. You're like, stop it.
Yeah.
Stop it.
Like, everyone pull it together. We're fine. Yeah.
Now, of course, you've got your Frenchie laying over there in her therapy bed, but we have to talk about the first Frenchie.
So, oh my God, so Vaca. And it means cow in Spanish. So she looked like a cow, and I adopted her. And she was rescued from a puppy mill. So this is so weird, but her nipples were so big and stretched out because of how many puppies she had.
Yeah.
It was so sad, but I felt like, okay, she's healing, I'm healing. Like, we're going to do this together. And yeah, so I got her in February of 2020, and then
after the stroke. I mean,
yeah, after the stroke.
Yeah,
during my healing process, during recovery. I got her in February and she was just the best. So sweet. Like, loved her. She was my little buddy. It's so funny. It's just like, dogs just love you. Like, they don't care what's going on. And so when I got fired in March, you know, I came home, I was so upset. I remember opening the door and she was just sitting there. She's like, "Mom, we're going to be poor, but it's fine. Like, look at me, how cute I am." She's the
best. I know you just got me, but I like this hoe. Yeah, yeah.
Don't give me away just yet. I barely cost you any money. Like, come on. So, I mean, she was just such the light of my life. And then, I got fired, whatever. That was horrible. And then it wasn't until, I got fired in March. So I think it was May. Maybe at the end of March, it's all fuzzy, okay?
Yeah.
A month or two later, I take her in to get spayed. And then she had to have another procedure done on her nose because Frenchies are hard to breathe sometimes, depending on their nose. So she had that done. And then she came home from a surgery. Everything was fine. And like a day or two later, she started puking nonstop. And so I took her to the vet. And then I take her in. They're like, "Yeah, she has ammonia." I was like, "What?"
Oh, no.
And then it just like quickly, then I had to take her to like this emergency vet hospital and they were like, "Yeah, we have to give her a blood transfusion." I mean, I was so in love with her that I was like, $3,000. I was like, "Whatever, just take my savings." Of course not. No, I mean, even though I just got fired, I was like, "Take every penny I have. Like, I don't care." Meanwhile, my dad's like, "Put her down."
Oh no, come on, Dad. Come on.
Such a dad though. You know, he's like worried about my finances. I'm like, "No, I will live on the streets before I put her down." So then they do the blood transfusion and they were like, "You know, she's just not going to make it." And this was all at the beginning of the pandemic too. So it's like, I couldn't go in there with her. They had to come and take her out. And then they did let me, they were like, "Okay, when we decided like, okay, there's just no other avenue. Like I would have to take her to get like monthly blood transfusions. And there's not even like that many of those type of hospitals around Colorado." So I was like, "All right." We did everything we could. I was able to go in there when they gave her the shot to put her down, and emotional wreck. Like to the point the vets were like, "Should we call someone?" I'm like, "I'm gonna be okay, I promise." But yeah, I got to hold her when she left this world, and she was just such a blessing. And I think about the life she must have had before me, just like at that puppy mill, like how horrible. At least, you know, I was with her the last few months and she was pampered and
got
loved
to live like
so
a queen
much.
Those last few months.
Oh my God. Yeah. She was so loved and really helped me like during some of the most difficult times on the recovery journey.
Yeah.
Like when I look at my recovery, I think I really thought like the hospital was going to be the hardest part. And really I was like, "Oh my God, the hospital's a piece of cake." Cause every day I had one mission. It was to get physically back to walking, move my arm. Or in life, I'm like, "I'm just a mess. Like I need to talk to my therapist." So, and
yeah, because in the hospital, life was on hold. Life is like, your only life is in those four walls and the halls that you walk up and down.
100. So that was really like, when I look at my recovery, that was the easy part. And it wasn't even that easy, but that was the easy part. And so coming out and like dealing with regular life was really the hardest. And, you know, I had her through it all and she was the best. And so we put her down. And then in May, I moved back home with my parents. And then I got Frida in September and she is a completely different dog. Like Baca was very chill, quiet, just wanted to hang with me. Frida is like her own person. Like she wants to go out for walks, you know, wants to hang out with other dogs. Like, well, I think she misses me sometimes when I'm at work, but not always.
But I think also you're ready for Frida.
Yeah. You know, like I'm for this.
You
type
needed
of dog.
Baca when you're recovering. You can't.
Right.
They're take
totally
her out for
both
walks
where
like
I
that.
Was in
yes,
life. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
And Becca was very slow. And, you know, we could walk around the block once or twice, which is when I was trying to like strengthen my leg more. And now I run every day. So Frida's like, "Cool, let's go out for a really long walk, Mom." So, yeah. Oh my God. And that goes back to God's timing, right? Like maybe it was time to let go of Becca at that time and to make room for another dog that is what I needed at the time.
I know you mentioned Chicago a few times, and I was going to guess either Chicago or maybe Detroit or something like that, if only because of the way you say "ma'am."
Oh,
that's
ma'am.
The only
way.
That's the only way. I'm like, okay, she keeps mentioning Flint, but that's where she worked, you know, out of college or whatever. So it's got to be somewhere else. Maybe Chicago. Maybe there's some Michigan. You know, elsewhere in Michigan. No, Is that something, you know, that that accent, that northern accent, is that something that you have worked on to suppress, if you will, get rid of? I was gonna say suppress, but you could say get rid of. Yeah. Is that something?
Especially when I started anchoring, my first news director, who's very much still a mentor and a very dear friend, I remember her taking me to her office. She's like, okay, we got to work on the A's. Like, they're just too much. And so I worked really hard to get rid of that. But I feel like I'm so far along in my career now. Like, when it pops out, to me, I think it's like charming. And it's just, I'm a real person, right?
When it pops out, when it pops.
Yeah, when it pops out sometimes, especially when I'm mad. Like, oh my God.
Wow, look at you.
Like, Southside's coming out. Everybody hide.
Now, yeah. Every other word is mad. Pop, mom, it's that's so good. That's so good. But when you're in Flint, you're like, okay, that's cool. But when you get to Denver, like, oh, okay, all right, we've got to work on it a little bit. How is it in North Carolina? How are they with it?
So the things that I'm working on for anchoring here is definitely like my pace. I'm naturally like a really fast talker. So getting behind the desk, you know, it can like speed up and. Yeah. So we're really working on my pace. And like, I feel like we're fine tuning, which is nice because it's not like, whoa, girl, you're still a hot mess. But my boss is truly incredible. When I first got, like after my first week, we had like a little sit down and he was like, okay, we're doing great. And I just want you to know that you don't need to impress anybody. The only person you need to impress is yourself. Like, you don't need to do anything for me. And I just told him, like, listen, I just want to make you proud because I feel like you took a chance. I mean, right away, he's like, I didn't take a chance on you. Like, I knew you were going to be great. Like, your brain injuries, whatever. But he's like, we just want to get you back on the bike. He's like, because, honey, your bike broke. Like,
here's a new bike.
Yeah, he's like, we want to get you back on the bike. Like, so just take your time and we're going to figure it out. And he's been like that every single step of the way. So yeah, my anchoring is it exactly how it was when I left the business in last April or 2019? No, but I think it'll get there. It's just, I'm rusty still. I've only been back 2 months and, you know, I'm constantly looking for help. I do feel like a little sponge. Like, who else can look at my shit? Like, what do we need to work on? And my agent calls me every week and, you know, we look at my tape and she's like, okay, see here, like, let's slow down here. And she talks to Brian and they both, you know, kind of team up. And it's nice to like trust them because like, I don't think they're like doing anything shady. Like, I think they genuinely want to see me succeed. And so when they both talk, like last time I talked to Brian, he's like, oh, I just want to let you know, I was talking to Carolyn. And I was like, oh, you guys were talking shit about me. He's like, we weren't talking shit about
me. He's like, if we were, I wouldn't mention it. I wouldn't start the conversation and be like, oh, by the way, we were just talking
shit about you. When they get on the phone, I don't think it's like, this bitch is a hot mess. You know, it's like, okay, she's doing great. I'm seeing progress, but you know, we just need to work on the pacing a little bit. And so that's what we're focusing on. And it's nice to have like those people around you that genuinely want you to succeed and are doing their part to like help you.
Outside of the newsroom, and I know you just posted about this recently on Instagram, the idea that moving to Asheville, North Carolina, okay, I'm Latina in North Carolina, the Latin community.
Horrifying. Yeah. I was reaching out to so many people. I'm like, oh my God, am I going to like it here? Am I going to be the only brown person? Because Denver is very, very white, but they do have a larger Latino population. And as soon as I got there, I was like, I dove right in. And so that's kind of what I do when I go to a new city, because being Latino is amazing. It's like being part of this gigantic family. Like, no matter where you go, like, if you're one of us, you're one of us. And so I was scared, like, oh my God, I'm not going to be able to have that comfort zone here. And I'm already in the South, which is somewhere I've never worked. And frankly, I was a little afraid of. And so I was like reaching out to people. I found this like Spanish, there's no Spanish TV stations here, but I found the Spanish newspaper and I reached out to the editor there. And right away, she was really sweet. She's like, no, I know you probably think there's like a ton of racism here, but of course, there's a sprinkle, but I love living here and I don't experience something, you know, it every day.
Girl, there's a sprinkle everywhere. There's at least a sprinkle everywhere.
100%. The first time I was really faced racism was in Quincy, Illinois, and that's 5 hours out of Chicago. So I mean, I know it's everywhere. I'm not afraid of it, but I just don't want to like live in a community where I'm afraid to leave my home because I'm going to face it every day, you know?
Yeah.
And so she was like, no, you're going to love it. And I reached out to, there's a reporter here who's Indian. So I noticed she was like one of the only other brown women in the newsroom. And she was like, no, it's fine. Like, you'll love it, blah, blah, blah. So I really just kind of took what they said and was like, all right, this is a great station. We're going to make it work. You have Frida, like it's going to be fine. And really, I haven't seen like anything that's out of the ordinary.
You just knock on wood. Did you just knock on wood?
I did, because I just do not want to. I don't want to deal with anything crazy.
I don't know if that was that the water she's drinking. I don't know. I swear. No, I think she just knocked on wood.
I really haven't really experienced anything horrible.
That's good.
Which is nice.
Is the goal to get back to Chicago?
The goal really is, I would love to get back to Chicago, but I definitely want to. Asheville is beautiful, and I always say this because I am so thankful for this job and the team I'm with, but I definitely don't want to live here. I definitely want to get back Midwest. Those are like my people. Like, I feel like they get my jokes on air sometimes. Like, yeah, like Denver, I feel like some people liked me, but I don't think they really like got my humor. Like Black and brown people get my humor. They think I'm fun. Like, they loved me in Flint. And I was like, those are my people. Like, they get me. And so it's like, yeah, if I can get back to like Detroit, Cincinnati over there, like that would be amazing. But I do, this is such a great place right now and I love it. And so I try not to get like too far in advance where I'm like, okay, like let's think, what's our next move? Like, let's stay in this moment and really embrace how happy we are in this very moment.
Yeah, the idea of, okay, I love where I'm at now. Let's focus on the now. Yeah, let's plan for tomorrow. Sure. But I don't need to worry about it. I don't need to worry about what's happening in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. Can't do anything about it.
Right. So, I mean, I even like every day I try to take like account like how beautiful the day was. I mean, today's my day off, but I was able to go to an Orange Theory class, which is something in the hospital like I probably wouldn't even thought of that I could do again. And so I'm able to do that. I live on my own, you know, run to the grocery store and, you know, take Frida for walks. Like, it's very much like the life that I wish I could have had in the hospital. Like, I have that back and it's beautiful.
It's so frustrating that in this day and age that still medically things can happen like your stroke or other things where there really is no explanation for it. Did the doctors ever offer any kind of explanation at all as to what happened, why it happened?
So the, in the hospital, like they, I feel like every doctor I've had has really loved me because I'm open to whatever. And really, like, I'm just like this medical mystery. Nobody knows what happened and why it happened. Like, the closest thing we ever got was that we all have this thing in our body called protein C. I'm sure there's an official word name for it, whatever, but it's called protein C. And basically it's a protein in our body that thins our blood naturally. And so mine was really low. That's the only thing they found, but it was never like, you know, this is it.
Right.
They were just like, here's a test that came back that your numbers are a little low. That was the only thing they kind of thought, but my physiatrist at Craig was the best and we're really close. And he was like, you know, there's a certain percentage of people we just never find out. Like, it was caused by a blood clot, but what caused that blood clot?
Right.
No idea. Right.
And any fear on your part that it could happen again? Or is that something that's like, you know what? I give that to God too.
100%. I feel like I don't really think about that ever. Initially, I think when I started living on my own, I was like, oh shit, you know what? You know, you're the chances of having another stroke after we have a stroke is high. But I just feel like God is leading me on this path and I'm not sure if it's going to go. I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure if it's going to go through stroke again. I hope not. But I mean, wouldn't it be easier? Because I already kind of know what to expect.
Yeah.
But no, I don't think about that. I really try to focus on, look how everything I've overcome and how beautiful life is in this moment. And, you know, I think God has big plans for me. And all I need to do is continue to follow his path. And, you know, that's what I've been doing thus far. And I feel so happy and lucky to be alive and in this moment, this very moment.
You said your family calls you Christy. I feel like I'm family now. So I'm going to just say thank you, Christy. I really appreciate it. Spending some of your day off with me. Thank you. Appreciate it.
It was awesome talking to you. Thank you so much.
You can watch this episode on YouTube and DBNA TV. Follow the Aaron Bender podcast on your favorite platforms and link to it at aaronbender.com. That's also where you can find all my social media. If you have guest ideas or comments, email me aaronbendermedia@gmail.com. Be well, and thanks for listening.